Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. They are here to answer your questions. Make sure that your garden and your lawn and everything is ready to go for fall. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. This is always a popular show, so call early. I am not whistling Dixie here. 800-348-2551. And you really don't want me to whistle Dixie here. There's music playing. You can email us as well. People have done that already. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. We have Greg. We have Fred. They're ready to answer your questions. It begins after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, and we welcome back Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. We welcome your gardening calls, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. After a long absence, Greg Ward rejoins us. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you, Ray. Thank you.
Great to have you back in the studio. Now, since you are in the studio and Fred is on the phone, I'm going to give you the option. Do you want to have him on the show or not?
Oh, that's interesting. Let me think about that.
Yeah. Well,
for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, hello, Fred. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me, Ray.
Nice
to be wanted.
You know, I sent you a picture the other day, a couple pictures, out in our backyard, sort of this small frontier area between our backyard and the neighbor's two backyards. There's this kind of, it's like a World War I no man's land in the middle. And we saw what we thought was a soccer ball out there for a couple days. And I was like, oh, somebody left the soccer ball. And then we were out yesterday, and it was yellow, or 2 days ago, and it was just brilliant yellow. And, of course, I'm too lazy to walk the 40 feet over to see it, Fred, first. And sent a picture to Fred. He said, oh, what was it, Fred?
It was a giant puffball, right? Unfortunately, at the stage where you took the photo, it's you know, sort of off color now. It originally would have been really, really, really white. And when they're white, they're actually quite good. I like to say it's probably one of the most underrated mushrooms out there. They're edible. They're quite good as long as you ID them correctly. But once they start to turn color, then I let them go, and, you know, the spores can go. And, you know, as a kid, we used to step on them. They make the big puffy cloud of smoke. That's the same kind of mushroom if you've ever done that as a kid. It's funny you should say it looked like a soccer ball because, you know, A, it does look like a soccer ball, and B, I took my youngest son, Mikey, out mushroom hunting with me, and we were walking along a creek, and sure enough, I see a nice, perfectly round white. I say, hey, Mike, looks, it's a puffball. He runs over. It was actually a soccer ball, right? He was really happy. I think he was more happy about the soccer ball than he was the mushroom.
Well, Greg, do you eat those?
Yeah, so I have a quick story about a puffball. It was the size of a soccer ball. I didn't find it. My wife's uncle found it, and they had it for when they're nice and white, you can start, you know, slicing them up, butter in the pan.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they're delicious. But it was so big that, you know, they kept it in their fridge for a few days, and then they gave it to his sister, my wife's mother, and they had it for a few days, and they got tired of eating it, and then we got it. It was still very fresh by keeping it cold. It stayed nice and white. It was great. So we had it for probably a week and did eat most of the rest of it. So they go a long way.
You know, I have a rule, basically, in my backyard. I do not eat anything that comes out of my backyard unless I drop a hot dog while I'm grilling. I am not... I don't know. I mean, I'll eat it, and then everybody will die. It would not be a good plan. And I'll blame Fred Breglia.
Well, you know, he didn't say eat it. I didn't technically say that. I said if you could ID it correctly, and it's coming out of a good spot.
Okay.
But it does bring up a good point, one worth mentioning, is that, you know, mushrooms are really good at taking toxins out of grounds. So if you have a spot that's questionable, and it's especially like industrial or even like residential, where things, including pesticides, could have been used in the past. I don't collect any mushrooms from spots where the soil might be compromised, because they're really good at taking that material out and holding it. And the last thing you want to do, especially if it's me, be responsible for taking out Ray on the air.
Yeah, I mean,
or off the air.
But believe me, there have been more than a few people who've been wanting to do that. So, all right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Gardening Today with Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and Fred Breglia of the Landis Arboretum. And Rose is in Glenmont. Hello, Rose. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You're on.
Pardon me?
You're on.
Oh, okay, great. I am calling about our lilacs. We have a border of our property is full of lilacs, and we've been here 26 years, and they were here when we came, so I don't know how old they are exactly, but they're older than that. And this year, for some reason, they dropped all their leaves. They look dead, and except they at the top, some of the leaves came back, and they're actually we have a few blossoms right now. The lilacs are blossoming, not a lot, but just a few at the top. So I'm wondering, are these dead, or are they going to come back next year? Or
okay,
what?
Let's go to Greg Ward.
Hey, Rose, no, they are definitely not dead. They are perfectly alive. What you are experiencing is happening to a fair amount of lilacs. So the leaves dropped off because of little infections, fungal infections that occurred during the summer, nice wet summer. So those leaves just dropped off. Anyway, lilacs, generally common lilacs or French hybrids, don't regrow a second time for the most part during the summer. So all the leaves that were on that plant that came out in May are the same leaves that would be there today if they had clung on. There's no second flush of growth during the July month that would sort of freshen up the look of the plant. So they are thinking it's fall. Yeah, a little bit of bloom is happening here and there. People have mentioned lilac, forsythia, even some rhododendron just showing a little color. That is also probably due to both the tremendous amount of rain and this continued sort of warm late summer that we've had.
Oh, okay. So let's wait till next year and
everything's good, yes.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
Rose, thank you for the call. It's Gardening Today with Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. The number is 800-348-2551. Richard is in lovely Lake Placid. Richard, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I have two invaders this year. The vegetable garden is very heavily invaded by purslane, and the front lawn, which is not really a very fancy lawn, is taken over by violets. Beautiful for about 2 months when they're purple and white, but they are choking out all the grass. What do I do?
Let's go to Fred Breglia on this one.
In the garden, I'd say, if you could hand weed. I don't like to spray anything in vegetable gardens. So, hand weeding or smothering would be probably the best options. Trying to keep on them, preventing them from going to seed is always good. And, using some kind of mulch could help suppress that. Maybe some straw, good layer of straw. As for the violets in the lawn, it's sort of a battle. If the lawn is doing really, really well and it's cared for and fertilized well, then generally the grass can do quite good at competing away any other competitors. If the lawn starts to get less fertile, fertility issues, shade will be a factor if it's not getting full sun. Certainly not an issue, I don't think, this year around here anyways for irrigation. It's been a lot of water. But sometimes even fungal issues will creep into the lawn. So it's often a matter of keeping the grass healthier than the surrounding weeds that want to invade. The grass is great at out-competing the weeds, but if the fertility drops, I don't know if you've been doing much fertilizing with your lawns and stuff, but if the fertility drops, then you're going to end up, the weeds tend to do a lot better when their fertility goes down. Lawn likes, it's healthy, it's strong, it's good, it's a great, great plant, but it does like a lot more nutrition to keep that bolstered health.
Richard.
And interesting. One more question then. Is it possible that I set the mower too low a height? Am I cutting the grass a little bit too low? Is that a factor?
It is a factor. factor. Yeah, you know, in general, it's been mm-hmm. proven that, you know, cutting the grass a little higher is better for the turf grass roots and the turf grass in general. It's going to have more, if you think of it, it's just basically more photosynthetic material, more leaves to be able to carry out its right. its processes. So, you know, in general, we always try to do the mowing on a little bit higher setting, which does tend to stress the grass out a lot less.
Greg Ward.
Yeah, I agree. Usually you are mowing higher. It's just that as we get to the end of October, there is a last-minute switch to cutting short to remove as much, not as much top as possible, but to bring the tops down a little bit. But we're talking maybe in about mm-hmm. 3 weeks or so.
All right. Hey, Richard, we have to take a break, but thank you for the call. Gardening Today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we will open the email bag in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's Gardening Today. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum and Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery are here to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We have a ton of email here, gentlemen. And I'll tell you what, let's do three or four, and then we'll move back to the phones for now and then go back to the emails later. This one came in over an hour before we started here. Suzanne writes, I have two young peach trees that yielded a bumper crop this past season. Other than mulching them pre-winter, how can I best support them for future seasons? And I will throw that to you, Fred.
All right. Well, you know, that's great. Peaches do really, really good in the Northeast. You know, a lot of folks are still, you know, always amazed when I, you know, sort of let folks know how good peaches can do, and it's great to hear that people are doing that. In terms of the health of the tree, you know, mulching it is definitely good. Mulching it wide, not high, so you really want to only be about 2.5, not more than 3 inches of mulch, generally, and wider the better, up to a certain point. But you could easily go out to the drip line of that tree, and if you were comfortable and had enough space, mulching it actually out almost twice as wide as the drip line would be even better, because that's where your feeder roots are, and you don't want really all the mulch around the stem that we often see in landscapes. It's actually not really helping a lot of the plants. In fact, if you're piling it up on a stem, you're going to probably end up causing some other problems, including rot and girdling roots and things like that. So mulching wide, but not high and not on the stem. Generally, I like to say with younger trees, you know, it's like the nutritional needs of an old tree and the nutritional needs of a young tree are completely different, very much like people, older yeah. folks and younger folks. You know, we're not trying to make the older folks necessarily bigger, but we are trying to create a stable growing environment. And that's just like pretty much right where we're trying to do with trees. The big tree, do we want it bigger? No. The young tree, do we want it bigger? Yes. So the nutritional goal or the fertilizer goal for that young plant is to get some growth in there. So on older trees, you don't always need to add too much fertilizer. But on the young plants, our goal is to make it big. So getting on to a regular fertilizer program, balanced fertilizer, organic fertilizer, that's granular. You can put it down yourself. You just literally where the mulch is. You can kind of scrape it away a little bit in the spring prior to growth. That's when the roots really start to take material in. And then again in the fall, it's another good time to fertilize. So, you know, getting it down. I don't like to fertilize early in the fall. I like to wait till the leaves are kind of two-thirds of the way down or half the leaves have dropped. That means your plant has, you know, successfully well on its way to going to sleep. But the roots are not, and the roots continue to gather material. So fall and spring, those are your best two times to get in there and do a little bit of fertilization. And like I said, make sure it's complete fertilizer with trace elements. A lot of times, you know, people just look for NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, yeah. potassium, but really those trace elements do quite a bit. And although they're not usually lacking in natural soils, it's good to make sure we're putting that down with a complete fertilizer. And a little bit of pruning wouldn't hurt, especially structural pruning, looking at preventing some defects that later could lead to branch breakages, reducing some of the aspect ratios of the branches. The aspect ratio is basically the branch in relation to the trunk. The trunk should be fat and the branches should be small. If the branches get to be large and the trunk's close to the same size, that aspect ratio is large, and those branches have been proven through research that they're much more likely to break. So a little bit of pruning, making good pruning cuts, any dead branches, looking for some crossing branches, removal of any suckers or sprouts that might appear around a base, and be on the lookout for any potential problems. And that would be sometimes leaf curl. You can see that. That's a fungal. And also borers are another thing. You'll see little sawdust or little secretions coming out of the trunk. Any of those signs, you want to get on it right away. But otherwise, keep the plant healthy. We can usually get the plant to outgrow most of the problems. You should be all set.
Fair enough. The second part of Suzanne's question I will throw to Greg. What are the best practices for post-season hydrangea care? I have both hydrangea paniculata and mountain hydrangeas.
Okay, the paniculata hydrangeas, you can do absolutely nothing, or you can do you can remove all the flowers to kind of, they get a little brown later in the summer, so you just want to tidy them up, so you can be taking those off. Any heavy pruning, which I do recommend on the paniculata hydrangeas, should occur in the spring, so April, a nice severe pruning to create new wood, create new large stems that will make nice big flowers. Mm. You mentioned mountain hydrangeas, and you threw me off there, Ray, but so I'm going to go with macrophylla hydrangeas, or the Asian sort of mop head types of hydrangeas, the ones that are typically blue or pink and round.
Mm-hmm.
So those should not be pruned at all. You really should just go through the winter and get into spring and let them do their own thing. Any little dead wood you see in the spring, you can remove. In our area, they have a hard time wintering and having that wood stay alive to make the flower. So the flowers are all set on the wood right now. That's why we're not pruning. So a little extra winter protection,
yeah.
Some kind of winter mulch. There's lots of things you can do. It can be just a pile of compost or mulch literally around the base of the plant. Some people like to wrap burlap around them. Just something to kind of keep that top alive. There's a few other hydrangeas out there, like oak leaf hydrangeas. Again, no pruning. They're blooming on new wood. The Annabelle or arborescence hydrangeas, which are technically a native hydrangea, those are white and round or snowball-like, bloom in July. Get a little confusing with the Japanese ones or the macrophylla ones I mentioned, but those actually, the arborescence types can be pruned to the ground anytime, so
okay.
This fall or in the spring.
So the term mountain hydrangea threw you there, and so we're not 100% sure which one she's referring to.
I'm not.
Okay, well maybe somebody will chime in there, and I'll give you this one, Greg. This is a two-parter from Ann and Adams, and I'll give you the first part and Fred the second part. I'm going to bring my herbs, sage, basil, parsley, in for winter and try to keep them going. I almost always fail miserably at this, especially with the basil. What should I be doing to keep them going through the winter?
Yeah, so I'm with her. I usually fail as well at some point during the season. Basil is pretty sensitive. Keeping it on the dry side, keeping it in a really bright location are the two things that you want to keep in mind. So a nice southern window, if all the herbs could be in a nice southern window. Sage, usually pretty good. Parsley is like the easiest one. Parsley just sort of grows anywhere. So nice bright window. Basil's going to want it warm. The other two, it doesn't have to be so warm. And don't overwater. Keep them slightly dry between waterings, and that usually works out.
All right, second part of this, and Fred will throw it your way. I just got a Hetzi juniper, and the nursery said to keep it well watered the first few weeks, but it's been raining all the time. Should I give it more water, or is all this stupid rain doing the job for me? And that's from Ann and Adams.
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, when you put new plants in, you know, folks always say you'll water it. I always say, you know, we want to get plants to be not just planted but established, and establishment could take a year or two, possibly even longer.
Yeah.
So you really want to water through that first year. Breaking up drought periods is the key. And when we get rain, it's a confusing thing. Do we water now or do we not? Well, it really comes down to how much rain are you getting and how deep is the rain going. And, you know, you could speculate, and I've done this, and then I've went out and tested my speculations, and although I'm more often right than not, generally. I've totally been wrong and said, okay, that's enough rain. We don't have to do it. Then when I do a test hole and see how far it went down, it only went down an inch, and you didn't really get nearly as much rain as you thought because a lot of it maybe rolled off.
Okay.
And so that's the case. So how do you know? Well, the only way to really know is get out there and dig a little hole, you know, not right around a plant, but somewhere nearby in similar soil.
Yeah.
After a rain, it's, you know, if you're getting a real heavy rain, you know, a couple of days of rain and some of those soakers that we've had, it's safe to say you don't need to go out there and test to see how deep it went. You know, you're good. But on those light rains or those fast thunderstorms that move through, if that layer, that top layer of the soil is dry, which it often dries out, even though we've been getting a decent amount of rain, that top layer of rain could run right off. So when in doubt, just check. Dig a little hole, and you really don't need to go that far. You just really want to go down about a foot, 15 inches. But you want that rain to penetrate 12, 15 inches into the soil because that's where your trees are. That's where your trees need to be saturated. We always say thorough waterings are better than, you know, more frequent light waterings, so less frequent thorough waterings. And how frequent's enough? Well, at least once a week during the dry times. If you're getting rain and you're not sure, get out and test.
Okay.
If it's a real soaker, you know it's good. But they should receive a good watering once a week through the growing season, spring through fall. And then the next year, if you get some really bad drought, I would urge you to consider watering during those really bad drought times again. After that, we kind of leave things alone on their own after that second year.
All right, Greg.
Yeah. I think you just covered it. We highly recommend a thorough watering every week for a new plant for the first year, and then to follow up the second year with a similar program when it gets dry. So, yeah, if we're going to get 3 inches of rain tonight and tomorrow, that's this week. You did it. You're off this week.
Ah. Yep.
But next week, you should come back and do your thorough watering.
Okay. Greg Ward is here from Ward's Nursery. Fred Breglier from the Landis Arboretum. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Joan in Schenectady. Hello there, Joan.
Hello there, Ray. I'm glad to be with you. And hello to Greg and to Fred.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Fred, I wanted to give you congrats on the plant sale last week. I really had such a pleasure with the camaraderie of the people working the program up there in the Arboretum.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. It was a successful sale, and you know it's a huge undertaking, and we have a great team, and we have some great supporters. So really, really appreciate the positive feedback.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, for sure. And I don't know if you recall, but we were doing a menu for Ray based on, I think, puffball steaks were the entree with a plantago and clover salad.
You're not helping, Joan. You're not helping.
I'll be bringing him in some special surprises for the next show.
All right.
I have a real easy, simple question for you. I gave in to an impulse and purchased a balloon flower, a platycodon, I think it says, grandiflora.
Yep.
Is that a native? Is that a what kind of plant is that?
Well, it's a perennial, and it has an incredible, it's a balloon flower. You know, certainly an incredible bloom. It does really, really well in gardens. It's a great, great, great garden plant. The native range on that, you know, I'm not 100% sure where that guy is native to. He's native to somewhere, but let me see if I can pull that up real quickly.
I mean, it could have been down to a minus 40 degree hardiness. Wow.
Yeah, they're really hardy around here. I mean, I know that you're very few problems with balloon flowers. I had them growing up as a kid with my parents. My mom always had tons of them. I've got them here at Landis Arboretum. And they do really, really well. They don't really require much work. They seem to be able to adapt to all kinds of conditions. And, yes, they are extremely, extremely cold hardy as well. So all around really good plant, you know, that I would say it's, you know, one of those ones you should have in all perennial gardens. And it's an older one. It's been around for a long time. I did look it up. It looks like that is probably going to be native to East Asia is what it's coming up as. Not a native to New York, but it does look like an Asian native. But I know, like I said, it's been around for a long time. There's no issues with that plant being invasive. It's a tried and true old variety that's still holds its own today in terms of flower power and probably underutilized more today than it used to be in the past.
Greg, did you want
to
jump in there?
Briefly, the one thing to remember about platygones or balloon flowers is that they emerge in the spring pretty late. And so don't forget where you put it because you will not see it until the very end of May.
Yeah, sometimes they get pulled out by accident. I've seen that happen as well, so that's a good point, Greg.
Well, Joan, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today on Vox Pop. Carrie is in Plainfield. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, Ray and guest. I have two quick questions, and they're both about ornamental grasses.
Okay.
Recently purchased a variety of different ornamental grasses, and my first question is, one of them's called, I believe it's rubrum, and I bought it locally. It said it was a perennial. However, I read later on that it's only winter hardy in zones 8 through 11. And I believe we're in zone 5. I live in the high elevations of the Berkshires.
Okay.
Yeah, we're zone 5 overall, and then you have pockets of, colder areas, and then there's pockets of warmer areas within those zones called microclimates. But overall, probably more of a 5.
Greg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, I was wondering if they're not going to make it through the winter outside, and I only have two of those, and they're still in their pots.
Yeah.
I was wondering if I could bring those in during the winter and put them out next summer.
They're interesting. So it is not hardy, as you said. It's really sold as an annual. So whoever told you it was a perennial, that was too bad.
Okay.
They're used quite extensively as fun summer sort of focal. Points the thriller part of a container that would give you some height, give you some color, and they're pretty tolerant of the cool weather. Not a true freeze or frost, but they'll look really good. Probably the way things are going these days, well into October, if not through October. So using them outside,
and they're outside now.
Yeah, using them outside is great. To winter them inside is tricky. They go green, they go then brown. I don't know whether you should water them or not. It can be done, but if you have a nice sunny kind of spot, you can stick them in the corner for the wintertime. That would be helpful, but it don't always seem to work out.
All right, Carrie, thank you very much. Now we go over to Judy and Dalton. Judy, you're on. Or not. Are you there, Judy? Going once. Going twice. Oh, Judy's gone. All right, I apologize to our listeners at home, but Judy was actually, it said she was there, but she wasn't there. Kyle in Greenwich. Kyle.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Two questions. Peach trees and mulberry trees. The peach trees we've successfully treated for the leaf curl fungus, but the string trimmer got a little too close, and I've got some damage to the bark. Want to know about care for that over the winter. And mulberry trees. I am the Bermuda Triangle of mulberry trees.
All right, Greg Ward.
All along my neighbor's fence lines, there's volunteers that grow and put out fruit like you wouldn't believe. And the trees I've tried to plant and nurture are dry, not a berry.
So you're not transplanting these mulberries from your hedgerow. You're buying them separately.
No, all of them were the same thing. Just volunteers that got relocated.
So I mean, there is some maturity that has to happen. So I would think that it may be a little early. I'm not sure how long you've had them in your yard, but. That would be the first thing I would consider, that they're just starting to grow. It will take them a little time to flower. And then that would be the second question. Are they flowering yet? There may be some issues with getting them to set flower buds, which, a nice mulch around them, treating them like any other fruit tree, not pruning them too severely, but just for form would be, I think the best thing to do. For the damage to the peach tree, weed trimmers are always a disaster to the trunks of small trees. And so creating that large mulched area around your fruit tree is not only good for the fruit tree in general in the root zone, as Fred was talking about earlier, but it really keeps you away from the trunk of the tree with the tree trimmer. You're much more likely to avoid that kind of thing. You don't want to go all the way around the tree with, you don't want to knock the bark off all the way around the tree. If that has happened and it's severe, that's not good. If you have some reasonably intact bark on most of the tree, it should callus up pretty well.
Good. Let's take a quick break here. Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum, 800-348-2551, the number here on the gardening edition of Vox Pop. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Gardening Today. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551. Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. All right, gentlemen, we have so many email messages, so many callers. We'll do a lightning round here for the rest of the show, and we'll try to keep it quick. And thankfully, Carol in Lake Luzerne wrote a one-sentence question about bleeding hearts and daylilies. Here it is, and we'll give it to Greg. Should I split and move bleeding hearts and daylilies now or in the spring?
Now.
You can go a little longer than that.
So daylilies really easy because they still have their tops. Bleeding hearts don't have their tops anymore. You have to sort of find where they are. And so you're going to lift the bleeding heart, and it might even come apart. There might actually be pieces already separate in there, and then you just replant them all. And yes, do that now. This is a great time. You really don't want to do it in the spring. Daylilies, you can divide daylilies any day of the week. I mean, you could do it in January if you could find them. So they don't care. You know, the bloom's going to come on in June, July. So you really want to, if you're waiting till spring, you want to do it as early as possible. But September, October, an excellent time to do it.
Splendid. This one is from Ray, and we'll give this one to you, Fred. What is the best way to collect tomato seeds from the fruit?
And the way we always did it was, and still do, is, you know, you basically leave that tomato on the vine, let it ripen the way it would normally, and then you take your select specimens. And I always like to pick, you know, a lot of people use some of the ones that aren't doing as good for the seeds, but I always say, you know, you plant good seed, you get better plants. So I look for the tomatoes that are just looking a little bit better, looking for the plants that are doing a little bit more. And when you get them, just slice them up. And I use a paper towel, sort of a brown paper towel, natural, and just kind of smear out. You'll see the seeds come out like gook, and if you, to lack of a better term, kind of like a slime, and you kind of smear them on there. And once they start to dry, that gook goes away instantly, and the tomato seeds will stick. So you don't want to let them dry till they stick. I kind of like move them around, kind of shuffle them around, let them air dry. And once they air dry, thoroughly air dry, then you can just go ahead and store them for next year, and you're good to go.
Okay.
But let the fruit ripen. I generally let it ripen out on the vine and then bring them in.
This one is from Mary, who says she lives in the Albany area, Zone 5B. Greg, Mary writes, I'm digging up a hosta bed under a dogwood tree. Do you have any recommendations for replacement plants that would do well under a dogwood, preferably plants that will produce food for people, birds, and or animals?
So one of the issues is to ask something to produce a lot of fruit in the shade is always tricky because it's not getting what it deserves. But the first thing that comes to mind is a partridge berry. Not that you'll have partridges coming to the yard, but somebody will eat them. And it's a nice shade-tolerant ground cover that should work actually quite well under the dogwood.
Now, a partridge berry, can a human eat that too?
You can. They're a little pasty.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, I like pasty. Okay. This one's from George and Fred.
The menu with the puffball steaks, right?
What? Yeah, we'll get together with Joan in Schenectady and we'll have a smorgasbord. All right, this one's from George, and this is for you, Fred, and then we'll go back to the phones. George writes, I've noticed standing dead trees with bark removed that looks like they have a spiral look. Do they twist as they grow?
You know, wood can spiral a little bit. Some trees you will see that with. Generally, the longer-lived trees, if you see standing dead, you generally don't see too many spiraled-up trees when they're younger. Now, what would cause a spiral grain or growth? Partially wind over a long period of time, prevalent winds, a loss of a branch in one section of a tree could get it to turn more. I don't generally see it too often in like I said, younger trees, but in old growth forests, when you go through an old growth forest, there's as much dead and as there is alive. It's a natural little balance there, and you know, you often do see that. And it's sometimes when you really see one in an old state, and they'll be like that alive as well. It's pretty dramatic.
All right, back to the phones we go here on this gardening edition of Vox Pop. 800-348-2551, the number. Brian is in Stone Ridge. Brian, you're up.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm sure you guys get this a lot, but we have a Japanese knotweed problem that exists between our property and our neighbors, and we've been choking it for about 2 years now with the heavy black plastic, but it does not seem to help as the knotweed is poking out on the borders of the plastic. We also have a well, so we can't use herbicides as recommended a lot online. The question is, because we have a pool getting installed next year, should we be thinking about stonework or cement to cover that area as the only solution, or should we just mow it next year and accept that reality?
Greg?
I think if you can mow it weekly, or and usually it wouldn't have to be weekly because they're a little slower than grass, but every, you know, twice a month, you will kill it. It's really all about if it's hiding in some pockets, maybe in your neighbor's yard, and keeps creeping back, those are the issues. So mowing it is ideal. Especially in the situation you described.
Once the pool goes in, though, then what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can't visually see what the issue is. If it's all about the, you know, you certainly don't want the knotweed coming close to the coping or the pavement around the pool. That's, you know, because it is a pretty tough thing. So you'll want to have some buffer that ideally you can mow, I would say.
Okay. Brian is dumbfounded, as am I. The number is 800-348-2551. Michelle in Conway. Michelle, you're on.
Hi there. I've got a question regarding clematis, and I'm getting conflicting information, so I thought I'd need to call the experts.
Okay.
The variety is Sweet Autumn, and one person said it's very invasive. Another person said, no, it's beautiful. You should grow it. What do you think?
I would lean toward the latter. So it invasive is really not probably the proper term, because that categorizes it with noxious weeds and things. They're not going to end up everywhere. They're aggressive. They're a big vine or a fast growing vine. So they will cover that split rail fence from post to post, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. But no quicker than say a trumpet vine or a wisteria would do. They're fragrant. Their timing is perfect. So they're in bloom now, which, you know, there's not a lot of things that are blooming right now. They're really easy to control. Once they say they're on your fence and you go, oh my gosh, it's just too much on my fence, I don't like all that anymore, you just can cut it to the ground in the spring or you know, late winter, and it will reemerge. It blooms on new wood, so you can sort of regenerate, you know, the entire plant pretty easily.
Michelle.
Okay, well that's really great news, because I have it growing on an old apple tree, and it looks lovely.
I bet it does.
This other person said, oh, you're going to find that vine's going to be everywhere just like bittersweet. And I said, oh, geez, no, I don't want that.
That is not true.
So,
okay.
Okay,
yeah,
very good. Thank
the bittersweet you. Is sort of what we call a killer vine, and it actually can choke plants out by strangling them or wrapping around them. And the clematis is not going to do that. It doesn't kill. And as Greg had mentioned, you know, pruning it is one way to control it a little bit. That one, there are some clematis that you don't want to prune like this one, but that one you can head back pretty aggressively, and that in itself can help keep the plant under check in terms of size.
It's the gardening show today. Fred Breglia and Greg Ward join us, and the number is 800-348-2551. Susan in Amherst. Susan.
Yes, my question is about the invasive jumping worms. I just discovered them in my compost. I dug them all out, killed them, but I understand they're all through my yard because my husband saw them when he was raking.
Mm.
What is that compost pile no good anymore because they've laid their casings or their eggs or however they reproduce?
Now, this is getting to be a real issue on this program, and we've been talking about it. Greg, you were not here last time, so I'll let you have first crack here.
Oh, great. So you know, Asian jumping worms in Massachusetts are sort of, they're just sort of arriving. There's a lot of discussion about exactly, you know, what they're going to be affecting. But your compost, sure, has the casings in it. Are you going to use that compost in your vegetable garden, which also has the casings in it? If that's true, probably doesn't matter too much. Probably the more important thing is if you have gardens where they're not, which it's not likely at this point if they're in both places, if you're ever thinking of giving the compost to your neighbor or some friend, those are the things that you would want to sort of limit or not do, obviously. So it's about containment these days with this worm. Killing the worms, as you described, in other words, collecting them from whatever your, wherever you're gardening, if it's your vegetable garden, if it's your compost, collecting the adults in the summertime and disposing of them is the only recommended control at this point.
Fred, I'll let you quickly jump in here. I know we could do a whole show on this, and I think every gardening show we do from here to eternity will talk about the jumping worms. But Fred, 30 seconds addendum here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real problem. It's, you know, there's a lot of invasives. You know, we can talk about a lot of the invasives, like emerald ash borer. That's wiping out all the ash. But the jumping worms, it's an issue because they're here, and they're not. There's no great, cure-all at this point. There's a lot of research being done. If you do see them, it is good to collect them and get rid of them. You know, putting them in a bag and disposing of them is generally the best recommendation to make sure they don't get out. Prevention is really the biggest thing.
How do you dispose of them?
You know, generally they recommend just collecting them, putting them in like a Ziploc bag and disposing of them in your garbage.
Okay.
And they will, they're not going to last long in a bag like that. It sounds bad, but, you know, we have to get rid of them. You can't let them spread. And you also don't want to get them out into any other environmental part of your property. In other words, if it's a wild spot, it might already be there. But prevention is really the best strategy right now. There's a lot of research being done.
Yeah.
I have gotten rid of them myself when I've seen them. A lot of times at night, you can even go out during one of those night crawler nights, and they're easy to identify between a jumping worm and the other worms that you have there, and easy to pick, and you can get rid of a lot of them that way. Compost, really quickly, I guess I'll end on that. If you do have compost bins and you're worried about jumping worms, first you want to make sure you don't, like Greg said, don't give the compost away, but also make sure your piles are meeting the minimum criteria to actually help heat up and destroy some of those casings. And I do have a little fact sheet on compost. A lot of people have been asking for it. It's just some, do's and don'ts and some minimum sizes. But if it's just a spread out pile that's not really tall enough and doesn't heat up enough, then you're not really going to reduce any of the other problems that you might have in that compost. And jumping worm casings are just one of them. But, you kill a lot of weed seeds that way. You kill a lot of things that way. So properly composting is a big first step, and prevention is another big one.
It was a long 30-second addendum. Another 30 seconds, the show would have been over. You said something about dehydrating.
Well, it's just another way to kill them, just to put them in an open container that they can't get out of and let them
gotcha.
Die that way.
Just all right, now to the, to the phones. Let's go to Sheffield. And Caitlin, you're on.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I recently purchased a property in Sheffield and have a little bit more land. And I'm interested in taking about a half an acre and turning it into a lavender farm. And I was wondering if I know generally from what I've read, it's quite complicated and quite cost prohibitive. But I was wondering, especially Greg, if you had any advice on that.
So in the Berkshires, lavender does work in the garden. It does want a well-drained soil. In the past, they've always been sort of moderately hardy. In other words, they'll work pretty well, but in some locations they'll stress and they may not persist as well. With climate change and our seasons extending, that seems to be less of an issue. That they're doing pretty well, especially in these last 4 or 5 years, and I assume that's going to continue. So in terms of trying it, I think, yeah, it sounds like fun. In terms of going for a quarter acre of it, you know, that does sound like a pretty expensive thing to start. So I might suggest starting with just some. If you're looking for, relatively inexpensive starts, there are lavender plugs available in the spring generally.
Fred, I'll give you a four-second addendum.
I think, Greg really nailed it there. Sometimes they're marginal, well-drained soil.
Okay. That was actually close
Thank
to four
so
seconds.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, Caitlin. We appreciate it. All right, Fred, go ahead, Greg.
I'll just say, Caitlin, if you want to, since she's so close, just stop in the store, send an email. We can work on that.
What is your email address?
So I like to use the info@wardsnursery email. That one gets to Jody, and then she can figure out who it's best for. But
so, in other words, that's the person who screens all the riffraff, like when I try to email Greg and she's like, no way, he's not getting through.
That's why I haven't heard from you lately.
Well, get her a raise. All right, Fred, because you gave me a four-second addendum, you get the last call here. We have 1 minute and 45 seconds. Start your watch, and let's go to Michael in Albany. Michael, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have two raised gardens where I have vegetables, and there's it's still in the growth stages with lettuce, etc., and I also have a dahlia garden. And this, I want to put field pea cover crop seed for overwintering. Is it too late to put the seed in mid-October?
Fred.
I don't think it is. I think you're still going to be, right now, we're talking, end of September. I think if you did it soon enough, I think you'd be all right. What do you think, Greg?
I don't know where you live, Michael, but I'm feeling...
Albany.
I live in Albany.
Maybe. I'm feeling like it should be going in now.
Yep.
I think Ron Kiowski, our gardener of the Berkshires, was talking about it.
So could I put those in with the vegetables?
No, you would clean out. You would only be putting it in places that you have cleaned up already. So you may not be ready for a cover crop yet.
All right, Michael, we'll have to leave it there. Fred, if people want to find out more about the Landis Arboretum, how do they do that?
Yeah, it's going to be our website, landisarboretum.org.
And the sale already happened last week?
It did. It was successful. It's already happened. We're in full-blown, let's get ready for fall. The leaves are starting to get, just starting to get nice around here. So
cool.
I'm expecting a pretty nice fall this year.
Well, thanks, Fred. Greg, how do people find Wards?
Yeah, wardsnursery.com or 600 South Main Street, Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
Super job, you guys. Thank you for being here. Support comes from the McCaden Theater, Chatham, presenting Summer in September with musicals Beehive and The World Goes Round, plus evenings of Kurt Weill and the songs of Linda Ronstadt, MacHaydenTheater.org. And Gardener Supply at Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, employee-owned and operated for over 50 years, offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice, gardeners.com. Once again, thanks to Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery for being here. Thank you for calling. I apologize to the zillions of you who didn't get through today. These guys will be back again, and we'll do it soon. This might have been the heaviest volume of calls we have ever seen on a gardening show, and we have done hundreds of these things. So these guys will be back soon. And thanks to Zach, the engineer, did it again. Susie Chekai is our screener on these Thursday. It's Thursday, right? Yeah, it's because you know why? Tomorrow, it's Food Friday, and we'll welcome back our buddies Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough, and we'll talk about Instant Pots and whatnot. Tomorrow at 2, we'll see you there.